I got there early. They got there a half hour late. There were three of them, two boys and a girl, Karen, Jeff, and Jeff. They all apologized at great length about how they had lost track of time. They told me how bad they felt, how they hoped it hadn't been an inconvenience. That's the thing about Ondines, just how unbelievably sorry they say they are about everything. Whether they ever actually mean it or not is a matter of some debate. After the pleasantries, it emerged they weren't going to talk about the Ondines at all. Instead, in typical cornerless style, they were going to limit themselves to gossiping about the other courts, and who was feuding with whom, all the high school cliquishness again. I begged them for specifics. "Can you at least give me an overview of the politics of the empires?" I finally asked in exasperation. They glanced at one another for a moment, and then the older Jeff broke into a sad smile. "Oh, of course, sorry. It's just that, well, meat wouldn't understand," echoed Karen and the other Jeff at once. "But we'll try to tell you in the form of a story," added Jeff Jr. And so, each took turns telling me a story, a parable, of how the courts relate to one another and to all the other bizarre subcultures of this world of wonders we live in. Don't blame me if it doesn't make sense. Blame the kids who blink too much and rub their eyes.
Welcome back to Walking Away from Arcadia. As always, I'm Simon, and my co-host Victor is here as well. And today, we're going to talk about the anime, The Changelings Nobody Plays.
Oh, it's sad but true. I love them so much, though.
Yeah, but... and to be fair, you know, my game has had two in anime in it so far.
I was one of them. Yes. I loved my anime. He was a delightful asshole. But yes. It was fitting.
Yes.
And they're just so alien, but alien in a way that's interesting and fun and engaging, and I like that.
We should probably start at the beginning with what are in anime and how are they different from typical changelings?
Yeah, so the anime are only barely changelings. They're like right on the edge of being true fey. When the shattering happened and all of the fey went diving for something to hide themselves in, all of the fairies that had deep relationships with humanity went through some variation of the changeling way and merged with humanity. And then there was this whole class of fey that were super duper animist, and their relationships were with aspects of the natural world. I don't want to say elements. There are fire in anime, water in anime, earth in anime, wood in anime, and air in anime, as well as one final one that doesn't fit into this initial backstory description. There's also the story hook that there are several other kinds that haven't survived, or have survived in such small numbers that you might find one, here's a story hook, have fun with it, but there aren't enough of them for us to flesh out. And so these spirits bind with some manifestation of the element they're associated with. It could be a boulder, a mountain, a tree, even a forest. And that's the body they're connected with. That's what they curl up in and hide from banality inside of. Whereas meat changelings curl up inside a person. It's really interesting and really odd.
And the metaphor they chose to go with breaks down slightly when you're talking about larger geographic sorts of things. The mechanics for the air elementals in particular, who I always think of as Sliffs, but they have a different name that I also don't know how to say. But
I think it's Paroseem, but I could be very wrong about that.
The air elementals have the revive mechanic for them is different in Dark Ages Fae, and it's just when they're exposed to their element, they revive after being killed. And for the air elementals, that's easy. For like a lightning elemental, that is actually probably permanent character death when they die. And in anime The Secret Way back to Dark Ages Fae and what they were in that, their metaphor, or maybe the system, breaks down when you're dealing with a large geographic feature like an entire air current, or an entire mountain, or an entire river as the anchor, because the anchor can be exposed to and harmed by banality, same as a changeling can be. And that gets really difficult to deal with really fast.
Yeah, it does. And just to define terms a little bit, when I was talking about these fae curl up in some manifestation of the element they're associated with, that's what Simon's talking about when he says their anchor. Each inanime has a specific anchor that is kind of their actual real body, that is stone or wood or whatever their element is.
Right, and it also gets difficult to deal with the fire elementals. You could have an Undyne, a water elemental, whose anchor is this whirlpool that kind of always exists in the bend of a river, but doesn't always exist. Or with a fire elemental, a Solomond, their anchor could be a campfire ring, which doesn't always have a fire. It gets difficult.
Yeah, when I first played the anime, I had a really hard time wrapping my mind around the air elementals and what an anchor would be. And I read a bunch of different descriptions, and especially for gladeling in anime, and the anime are broken up into two cords. They're gladelings that are connected to some form of their element that are untouched by humans. And then there are crafted or crofted in anime where their anchor has somehow been changed by humanity. The wood has been changed, a tree that has been carefully pruned and controlled in a garden would be something that's crafted. A river that's been dammed up and redirected would be crafted. And I was like, how do you craft air? And eventually, when I got all the way into the anime book, they talked about like the air that lives inside of a tuba or a saxophone, or maybe the air in steam vents. But it was hard to wrap my mind around, and it just made the uncrafted air in anime make even less sense to me because I'm like, but the air is just air. But then it's like the breeze through a particular valley or in a particular forest. So it can be a little bit difficult to wrap your mind around exactly what the anchor is, depending on the elemental.
And that gets a little bit into the backstory for an anime. Again, unless the particular writer who wrote that section forgot about it or didn't know about it, is around a Prometheus sort of story where the fire elementals were fascinated with humanity, and the inanime backstory doesn't line up or really even address the changeling meta plot at all, which is kind of interesting and kind of fun. But as sort of ancient gods, the fire elementals taught humans how to manipulate their environment because it would help them, and who could control fire? Mwahahaha, kind of a thing. And it sparked a war between the fire elementals and all of the other inanimate who saw their anchors suddenly becoming crafted, which is an extinction level event for most inanimate. And the fire elementals were more or less wiped out, and their realm in the dreaming was occupied by the earth elementals. And then the shattering happened, and almost all, if not all, of the inanimate went inactive. Because that's something they can do in order to hide from it, or possibly because they were traumatized by it. And they didn't start to wake up again, depending on which person wrote it, either just before the Xi resurgence, so around the turn of the 20th century, or at the same time as the Xi resurgence, or slightly after, kind of depending on who wrote that section of the book.
The entire idea of the resurgence as it relates to the inanime is kind of weird and complicated because unlike the meat changelings, who are all really closely tied to humanity and culture, the inanimate are elementals, and their realm in the dreaming, their realms, each type of inanimate has their own kingdom, can be accessed from their anchor. You kind of dive into your anchor and it acts as a pathway into the dreaming, but it is a realm unto itself. And they describe that each anchor connects to the kingdom. So the kingdom of air can be accessed from any air anchor. The kingdom of fire can be accessed from any fire anchor. But the thing that gets complicated is there's fire in China, Japan, India. There's, stone and water and trees in all of those places. But when you get into the changeling plot, the whole resurgence thing is complicated and it doesn't happen the same way in all the different places. And the kingdoms and their stories are very centered around the European changeling timeline. But what does that mean? Like, are there no inanimate in these other parts of the world? And if there are they connected to the same kingdoms? In which case, what was going on in these kingdoms while all the Western inanimate were asleep? Because it's made very clear that the shattering and the wave of disbelief wasn't as strong in some parts of the world, which makes sense given what religious beliefs are in certain parts of the world. So there's this part of the inanimate plot around the way they're globally connected to their part of the dreaming that is really hard to reconcile if you look much past America and Europe.
Yes, and there are minor kingdoms. One of the ones I wish got more word count is the Empire of Flickers, which is distinct from the Fire Nation. They're more light than fire, and that ties into the conversation we had with Salih about the cultural connotations of the djinn and how they're more an ephemeral inspiration sort of fire thing, but not actually fire. And all that gets me wondering if the kingdoms maybe shouldn't be a little bit more local than Secret Way makes them out to be, and maybe some kingdoms are bigger in other places than they are here, or maybe absent entirely from here.
Yeah, and that would make a certain amount of sense. The Empire of Flickers is also described as being not just about light, but about like TV and images, and there's artificial light like lamps and lights and the lights on a theater stage, but there's also all of these moving images we bring into our life. And there's a pretty strong indication that the Empire of Flickers overlapped the internet and all of these other very modern media constructs that we were creating. And that was a really interesting idea.
The other more modern faction of inanime, at least of the ones that get named in inanime, are the mannequins, who I have trouble thinking of as anything other than dolls because mannequins are creepy as shit. They are cast as kind of an entirely modern phenomenon, specifically referring to mannequins and dolls in modern department stores, things made of plastics. And I don't know if it was ever quite what was intended by that, but given that they're all thought of as crafted, there's no mention of a gladeling doll or mannequin, even though.
There is actually one reference in The Secret Way that I read recently, but it is so bizarre. It does say that if there is some natural formation that happens to look like a human, then it can be an uncrafted mannequin. But nothing is ever done with that name drop. It's like two sentences, and I don't know what narrative purpose it serves.
And I think that kind of ties into the inconsistent nature as to what a court is for an anime. Sometimes, like in the mechanical rules, the game says changing courts is almost always going to invoke death because you may not survive the touch of human hands to become crafted. And how do you become uncrafted at all is kind of left completely open. It may not be possible. And then occasionally, like in the Kith descriptions, they drop something like with the sliffs, they're pretty evenly split between both courts, and some of them flip, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense given the rule they made for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's never called out. The one way that I could see going from crafted back to Gladeling is if your anchor is destroyed, you become unmoored, and you have a period of time where you're a true fey wandering around in the world, and you will die very quickly. But if you can find something to anchor yourself to again, there is a slim chance that you can survive that experience. And I suppose that if you had a crafted anchor that was destroyed and you found an uncrafted anchor to reconnect yourself to, you could become a Gladeling again. But there is an incredibly high risk of just absolute undoing, no return undoing. And so I cannot imagine that happening with any frequency.
Right. So the anime, in a real way, are really their anchors or the spirits tied to their anchors. And they interact with the world through what the game calls a husk, but I prefer to think of it as a facade because husk is kind of a weird word. But from their element, they craft this thing that resembles a human being, much like a mannequin. And different inanimate have a different level of facility with this power. Some create very realistic facades that can pass as human as long as there isn't like a medical level analysis. And others get the shape and silhouette right, but if somebody looks at you from anything like a close distance, you're going to invoke banality pretty fast.
Yeah, and that's something that reinforces for me that the inanimate are kind of almost true fey, is that dynamic of you've been seen for what you are, take banality, is something that happened to all the fey in Dark Ages. In modern Changeling, I think strong disbelief on the part of a mortal and the mists coming in can act as a banality trigger if it's really intense, because it is being rejected for what you are, but it's not the same kind of absolute terms that the inanimate run into, because you really have to be doing something pretty extravagant to be seen as a meat changeling. Whereas the inanimate can just be, oh, that human made their awareness check and they can see that your eyes are unmoving stone and that is wigging them out, you know? So they're a lot more exposed in that respect.
They get a lot closer to that dynamic that the Firstborn had, where they didn't have a disguise, and if they had any what were called greater features, they automatically invoked disbelief if they weren't actively hiding themselves, either by disguising themselves as more normal-looking human beings or using the Fey equivalent of obfuscate to get people to not look at them at all. The inanimate have a similar sort of thing going on where you can kind of get around having a shitty facade if you use slivers to disguise yourself, and I think there was one that had a disguise power in it, but that's an active use of glamour, and that's really expensive in the modern period. The humans had chosen to live at the base of a mountain, and yet they were surprised when the mountain fell. Elizabeth watched from a hilltop. Her eyes gleamed like a cat's, and she wiped fresh cream from her mouth as the mountains sang to her. They sang of loss, time, and the beauty of warming and cooling over the months. Elizabeth belonged to the Spring Court, so she could appreciate the moment where cold ended and warmth began better than other fae. She crouched low in the shadows of a great willow tree and watched the people of the village. She might have felt sorry for them, But fate was fate. The mountains were singing, and Elzabet had an oath to fulfill. Of course, the humans didn't remember the oath. They remembered to leave cream out for Elzabet, but not always. Other villages were better about that. They remembered to place iron at the door to keep out trolls and other feral sprites. But lately they began using the iron to shoe their horses and other such barbarism. Elzabet heard the song of the mountain telling her that the humans had broken an oath, and so she sang back. Her small body hardened, her eyes changing from gold to green to black. Her hair solidified into strands of fine stone, and powdered rock fell from her mouth and ears. She reached up, and then slammed her tiny fist into the ground, taking control of her power over the earth and rock, and unleashing it. Somewhere up on the mountaintop, a boulder worked itself loose from its moorings. Maybe it would have fallen the next day, or the next year, but it would have fallen, and so Elzabet didn't feel guilty about pushing it. The humans had promised to stop mining when they reached the black glass, but it had taken them generations to reach it. Some of them felt the oath then. Some of them had seen that dark shimmer from the rocks and wanted to stop. But most of them didn't. "Take what you will from the mountain," whispered Elzabet into the night, "but leave my black glass there, for it is sacred as a lover's blood to me." Her lips grated together like stone on stone. The unleashing was nearly complete. "Take the black glass, and take the rest of the mountain as well." As the boulder crashed down the mountain toward the village, knocking loose hundreds of its smaller brothers on the way, it occurred to Elzabet that maybe the humans simply hadn't understood the oath. No matter now, fate was fate.
An anime, with the exception of the mannequins, cannot use arts because they're completely different fairy creatures. So in the original book, in anime, The Secret Way, they had kind of their own special arts and their own special realms. Simon has more experience with them than I do. I have to be honest, I started to read them and I did not particularly care for the systems. So yeah, I'll let Simon describe that in more detail.
The Inanime, not only do they have their own arts, they also have their own realms, which gets weird fast. Their realms are the easiest ones to describe because they're a little bit more concrete than everything else. And they have a favored realm, just like changelings do, generally. And their realms break down into the four-ish classical elements: earth, fire, air, water, and the mannequins get sort of a neutral element realm. They get spirit, so they don't have a weakness to their opposed realm because there isn't an opposed realm for spirit, but the other ones, they have a weakness to their opposed element, and it's more difficult for them to learn. They're also a bit redundant with the slivers, which can cause some confusion. The writers tried to make these elements encompass what some of the other realms did too, and that gets a little bit awkward fast, because what element do you put Actor or Fae in? Nature? Maybe? But they don't. But they're pretty simple otherwise. The Earth realm affects Earth. Fire affects Fire. The slivers, though, they get kind of strange. It took me a while to figure some of them out. Some of them are pretty solid, though. Petros is a pretty solid example of a decently built power set. The only thing in it that's weird is a higher level power in it called Stasis, which reads like an invocation of banality, which is just kind of thematically strange for Changeling. And then the Kubera get Vertige. Vertige duplicates some of the primal powers. They get a version of Willow Whisper. Then there's the Ondine Sliver, Aquis. And it's kind of a bad collection of puns. They get Aura Viewing, Time Control, and Friction Control powers. Friction Control, I'll give them. That kind of makes sense. Water's a lubricant, sort of. The only thing I can justify time control with is somebody thought, oh, the flow of time. That would be clever. Let's use that. It's kind of everything I hate about the old primal power.
Those descriptions were all from the original book, In Anime, The Secret Way. And when C20 came out, they decided to go a completely different route with In Anime Magic. And the slivers still exist-ish, but they can only be unleashed. You cannot do cantrips with slivers in C20, which creates a number of systematic problems. But instead of getting levels, each sliver has like a one paragraph description of the sorts of things that fall into its domain. You still purchase levels of them, but the levels really just serve as your dice pool for helping to keep control of the unleashing. And they have a couple other things. When you learn the slivers, they give you almost like extra birthrights for knowing the sliver, which is kind of cool. And that was also in The Secret Way. It's weird. I kind of understand why they did it, because it was very evident in C20 that they wanted to avoid having a lot of duplicate powers. And the slivers were incredibly duplicative, because they had to be, because they were all the inanime could purchase. Aside from mannequins, they don't have any sliver ban or advantage, but the flip side of that is they can learn arts. Now, it's incredibly expensive because they have to learn realms to go with the arts, and they don't get any starting realm points. Just getting your mannequin up to the point where they will be able to do anything meaningful with their arts is incredibly expensive. But there it is, they can do it. It's kind of a big advantage, especially in C20, because they're the only ones that can even do cantrips. But before, the slivers for the rest of the inanime, they had to duplicate a bunch of powers. Oh, well, we have to put a healing power somewhere. Oh, well, we have to put a major damaging power somewhere. Oh, well, we want an anime to be able to will-o-whisper, because of course it makes sense that they would talk to the natural world. And so it just ended up being really awkward.
And bringing up the mannequin's relationship with the slivers and the realms gets us into talking about the way all of the phyla interact with those things. The slivers and the realms are all tied together into the favored and opposed system that they built around the phyla. I think here would be a good place to go into the different inanime phyla. Victor, do you have a favorite phyla?
I do have favorite phyla. My favorite phyla are unquestionably the Parasemes. I don't know why I love them so much, but they just seem especially capricious, and I tend to play a lot of capricious characters. I also kind of like them because it's hard for me to imagine exactly what their husks look like. How do they do things? They seem a little ineffable. And I know for a lot of players, oh, I can't wrap my mind around this would normally be a deterrent. That's totally an attraction for me. If I have to like struggle and fight and work to like figure my character out over the life of the character, then that keeps me engaged. There's a reason I usually storytell and I don't usually play. But yeah, I love the Parasemes. I think they're a lot of fun. And the Parasemes are the air phyla. They represent the wind and the sky.
They're kind of jerk-ass piskies.
They really are. They're fantastic. I also love Piskies, actually. So that explains a lot. Probably my second favorite, also because kind of the jerk-ass element, is I love Salamanders. They're jerks in a very different way from the Parasemes. They're kind of jerks in the I don't actually understand how any of this works, and so you have no idea how I'm going to behave. I love the Salamander in the opening art to Secret Way. He totally just grabbed me. What's your favorite phyla?
Well, I do really like the salamanders too, because they invoke the Prometheus myth and kind of Loki too at the same time. They're like super inspirational, but it's completely a moral inspiration. They teach humans how to manipulate their environment, despite giving that power to humans having obvious and catastrophic effects on all of the other inanimate. And they justify it to themselves by saying, oh, well, you know what? We're fire. Who can control fire?
I especially love that story because if you go back and really look at the whole mythos of the world of darkness, humans gaining the ability to weave was probably the single most terrible thing to happen ever. I mean, of any sort. Everything that is wrong with the world of darkness kind of goes back to humans gaining the ability to weave. And I know, you know, every game has its little creation myths, and oh, we're responsible for all the important stuff in the world. And so, unreliable narrator, grain of salt. But I kind of love the idea that this forgotten, little, trapped, diminished group of fairies that no one remembers exists, that even most fairies don't know about or understand, are the root of every catastrophe in the world of darkness. Like, it just, that just satisfies me.
Yeah, and getting back to the Chromeborn a little bit, there's a weird interlude story kind of in the middle of it that's not about any of the main characters, and the main bad guy is basically a Solomund, and it's this weird crafted salamander that was stuck basically in a brass tube, and the brass tube got made into a flag, and it was one of the flags that led the Crusades, and one of the flags that led a bunch of Nazis through World War II, and this salamander ends up causing dozens and dozens of atrocities throughout time, and I just love that. It's such a good bad guy.
I love that as well. They're great bad guys without actually being evil. And that's hard to come by in the world of darkness, actually.
I actually also really, really enjoy the Gloams. Because they're ostensibly the bad guys in an anime, at least as far as the Gladelings are concerned internally, because they're occupying the Salamander's kingdom in the Dreaming. But they're the weirdest bad guys ever. They're philosophers who rarely decide to act. Like,
Well, and I didn't necessarily read them as bad guys. I sort of read them as corrupt good guys. Like, they took action against the salamanders, which was justified. Then they went way past justified action. But they aren't doing anything to any of the other Gladelings. I didn't read any story about there being a risk of their autocratic, sort of authoritative approach to the salamanders spreading, because they're not human. They aren't lured by power. They don't care about power. They're just, once they make a decision, they commit to it totally. And like Earth, they don't move. They're just stubborn. I sort of read their whole thing with the salamanders as just an expression of what happens when just like the total archetypical ridiculousness of an element is applied to a political situation that needs adaptability. They're completely incapable of adapting without an event as dramatic as what the salamanders did initially that pissed them off. And that's just not going to happen again. So that's kind of how I read them as opposed to as villains.
yeah, I can see that. The other thing I really, really like about them, especially in the context of the occupation of the Fire Kingdom, because everything was okay until the Earth Kingdom attacked, is especially in this part of the world that I live in, a huge part of my state is basically dormant volcano. Like, this state is built on the corpse of a fire elemental, and it turned into Earth. I can't, like, look at the politics of the anime game without thinking of that and thinking how much the Earth Elementals benefited from the Fire Kingdom basically stopping existing.
Well, that's actually really fascinating. I love that idea because that is sort of the arc of our world. It used to be much more geologically active. There used to be more volcanoes. There used to be all of these other elements. And, you know, it's easy to look at the Gloam's action against the fire elementals and be like, oh, they're villains. They're, you know, autocratic dictators. And then step back and think, but what would happen if the fire elementals retook their kingdom? What would happen if, you know, Yellowstone woke up again? It's a really interesting story. I think, especially given that White Wolf, with their new edition, has said they really want to engage with not, okay, here is the end of the world, we're done, but instead go back to right before they ended everything and say, all right, now we're going to live in the end times. Full disclosure, I personally am not super engaged by that concept generally for a whole edition, but they kind of have implied they're going that direction. And this is one area that I actually would love them to tap, because I feel like the inanime have a lot of potential in that area, and they're so often forgotten about.
Inanime did have a hook about global warming being caused by all the kingdoms being thrown out of whack and out of balance with each other. I'll just drop one more thing about the Glooms, then I'll shut up about them. Their weakness is hilarious. Their husks all weigh way more than they logically could, so they interact with the world as if they weighed a couple of tons, which is comedic gold to me.
That is kind of amazing. The other thing that stands out to me, you mentioned how the fifth level Earth sliver was stasis. That is, I believe, now the fifth level of winter. And I think that's really interesting because, in the secret way, the Glooms are associated with the winter solstice. But they don't get winter in C20. So there's this narrative link to them. There's this narrative link between them and the winter solstice. This power that used to be part of their sliver is now in the winter art, but they don't get access to the winter art.
Yeah, and the Nunahi also, their winter camp, is also tied to stone and stasis. So that's a theme somebody's drawing out. I don't understand it, but it's there. And then the next phyla are the Undines, or for some reason they think it's pronounced Undines. I guess I don't want to argue that, but they're the water elementals, and they're all really kind of the clearest evocation of what I think the theme of the game is, based on the source mist they went with. Undyne, obviously. They're all these. It's a cluster of stories. There's the story of Unda. There's the Little Mermaid. There's the Rusalka. All of these are stories about things that aren't human coming into relationship with humans, often to disastrous effect.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, in the original write-up of the Undines, I'm just going to pronounce it Undine because I think it sounds better, aren't they listed as the phyla that is most concerned with the heart question?
Of all the inanimate, the Undine's phylum is best suited to concern itself with the heart riddles and other matters of the human soul.
And the heart riddles, or the heart question, is this thing that I want some definition around. Like, they don't need to tell me what it is. If it's intentionally unreliable narrator, I can get behind that. But I want more hooks. Like, I want more negative space and fake outs and something to give it a little bit of shape, because I really, for the life of me, don't know exactly what that is.
I've been thinking about that a lot, and I like the idea that the heart question is this like philosophical point for the anime that all revolves around why are we doing this? Why are we bothering with husks? Why are we interacting with humans? Why can't we stop?
Yeah, and that's fascinating, especially when you get in and look at all the systems around husks and what losing a husk does to an inanimate, and that they have this identity, this anthropomorphic identity that they just can't get away from. But why? Like, what is so special about human shape other than you need it to make it a viable role-playing character? In the world, what does it matter? And especially given how shifting water is, air feels more dynamic, but air just almost isn't contained enough to evoke shape to begin with, whereas water becomes what it's in, and it becomes this distilled, solidified, perceivable thing in a way that air doesn't, and yet it's always changing. And so, maybe it's not quite as unshaped and dynamic as the Parasims, but the Undines just evoke shape so much more that it seems more dramatic. And so I do kind of like the idea that they're the ones who are like, why are we doing this?
Especially with the way the World of Darkness generally treats water spirits, it's no kinder to the Undines than it is to any of the other water creatures. They all, their frailty, gives them some kind of physical deformity. I feel like it's very much related to the Miyazaki sort of thing in Spirited Away, where you have that big, evil-smelling thing coming into the spirit day spa, and nobody wants to deal with it, and then it turns out it was just a polluted river spirit. I feel like it's that point again, even though, Little Mermaid, Rusalka, Unda all had similar sorts of things going on. I think they kind of cranked that one up a little bit, and I think they did a good job with it.
I agree. And something that has always stood out to me about the relationship between the inanimate and meat changelings is there are meat changelings that sort of evoke inanimate. The rock giants sort of evoke Glooms. The Gillydew sort of evoke Kubera. But there are so many groups that could be Undine. There are at least two Nunhi groups. Arguably, all of the Menehune should have that sort of affiliation with water if you know anything about Polynesian culture. There are the Selkies, there are the Mer, there are the River Hags. The list goes on and on and on. And so, if you want to explore that, if you want to start asking questions like, did some meat changelings make oaths with Undines? Did perhaps a set of Undines find out, or a set of inanimate find out how to change anchors and anchored in meat at some point. And if that did happen, why were the Undines so good at it? They're really a phyla that suits those hooks very nicely.
And you mentioned the Kubera, which are an interesting case, at least to me, because all of the other phyla have maybe a little bit obscure but Western names. The Kuberas invoke an Indian deity, if I remember right, rather than going with a simpler dryad.
The Kubera do invoke a god of wealth, which kind of lines up with, spring and wood. The Kubera are dryads. Kubera or Kuvera, also spelled Kuber, he's the lord of wealth and the god king of the semi-divine yakshas in Hindu mythology. The interesting thing about the yaksha, and I only discovered them when I was looking up Kubera to find out, what the root myth for this phyla was. The Yaksha are kind of fairies in Hinduism. They are, sometimes they are sort of sinister or connected with sinister myths, but a lot of times they are nature fairies associated with woods and mountains. And I just find it very interesting that we've never really gotten many Indian myths. The Ishu are sort of listed as covering India, even though the closest thing you could get is that they wander and the Romani came out of India and the Romani wander, but the Ishu aren't connected with the Romani, so drawing a blank there. And there's this whole fairy, I'm going to say pantheon, even though fairies aren't pantheonic, for lack of a better term, group of myths that could be invoked. And so the fact that they pull Kubera for dryads is interesting to me that they draw this connection with a group that would make an amazing family of changeling kiths and fill out a big hole. But that's not, the Yaksha aren't dryads, and he's a god of wealth, which is kind of tied to nature in a lot of supernatural, a lot of magical systems, and a lot of mythologies, but it's not a strong, obvious corollary. So I'm not quite sure why they invoked that term for dryads.
The link there is their birthright. They have the ability to inspire fertility in many forms, including that of the mind. I recently learned about the Aspera, which are another class of Hindu and Buddhist creatures that are also very fae-like. They have both negative and positive aspects. They're all women. They're enticing spirits of air sent to inspire or distract mortals. So, one of the stories I read involved an Aspera being sent to stop a guru from achieving an attainment of enlightenment that would allow him to challenge the gods. She came down and did so. And he did not achieve his destiny because of that. But he had a really good time not achieving his destiny. And then there's the connection in Graceful Wicked Masks, which I get they were trying to evoke a all cultures and simultaneously no culture thing going on by using cultural elements from lots of places. I don't think they succeeded with Wicked Masks, but they tried. And the Fae in that are all Rakshas, which are another Indian thing. They're demons, if I remember right.
Yeah, the Rakshasa, mythological being in Hindu mythology, they were called man-eaters. They were really just awful, consuming, demonic destroyers of existence. The fact that they're sometimes connected to, more benign, well, they're sometimes connected with beings that are sometimes benign and sometimes evil is kind of interesting. They make an appearance in the Rig Veda. I didn't understand the Raksha connection, the random Indian association, until I looked up the Rakshasa, which I got to again through Kubera, but it makes sense. I understood the connection after I read up on them a little bit. The last phyla is a little unusual, and they are the dolls or mannequins. They aren't really like the other four phyla in that the other four phyla are all elementals. The mannequins are an elemental spirit that has just taken far too much form. They end up in some sort of inanimate entity that looks human. And so it's innately alien and not human. But it kind of has more of a human identity. Their major advantage is that they can learn and utilize meat changeling arts and learn their realms. They're supposed to be really kind of unsettling and unnerving. They're really an invocation of all of those mannequins coming to life and doing terrible things in department store stories. They're an interesting phyla.
My headcanon for them has been that they're hive organisms. They're all elementals from an oil deposit, or from a clay field, or from the things we make dolls and toys out of. And that thing was the original elemental spirit, and they're all invocations of that same spirit, which makes them creepier to me, anyway.
Does kind of make them creepier. It also ties them back to the unshaped really nicely. I think you get some amazing stories there about like the clay soldiers that are protecting the Forbidden City, or there are a lot of amazing doll ghost stories out of Japan. The cursed doll maker who makes porcelain dolls and gets all of his porcelain from a clay deposit near his house, and he lives on cursed land because of some atrocity that happened there years ago, and it's still tainted by whatever sin was committed, which then wraps it up into human sin, which is a very, Japanese trope. But like, I can see this story playing out, all of these dolls being connected because they all came from this same tainted elemental source. I feel like the mannequins have the most potential to just be straight up World of Darkness horror in all of an anime. The mannequins have a lot of potential for that.
I agree. They're the ones that are written most obviously to be the bad guys, especially with the crafted versus the gladeling dichotomy the game tries to set up, because they're the ones who are mostly crafted.
They are, and I've actually, I don't know how common this is, but someone was asking on one of the World of Darkness groups on Facebook about the sort of supernaturals that would be in South America because they were going to do some narrative stuff with it. And lots of people were making suggestions, and I pointed out, you'd have just as many in anime there as you'd have anywhere else because in anime are everywhere. And, he made some comment about you might find a bunch of, non-crafted gladeling, whatever, there probably wouldn't be a lot of crafted mannequins. And that was what he said. There wouldn't be a lot of crafted mannequins. And aside from the fact that that erases several multi-million citizen cities in South America, I had an exchange with him about that whole thing. It struck me as really odd that the line he drew was between Gladling and Mannequin, as opposed to between Gladling and Crafted, and then Mannequin being a third farther extreme, which is what's in the book. And I wasn't quite sure why he approached it that way. I haven't run into that other times, but I also honestly don't run into many people that know much about the Inanimate. This reading is from Wooden Feathers by Ursula Vernon. The marionette caught it neatly out of midair and grabbed the decoy's neck. She could see the fingers beautifully articulated, each ball joint perfect, ending in tapered points. The duck carving came alive. Sarah watched as her poor, mangled mallard suddenly stretched out its wings. She caught a glimpse of carved wooden feathers, the bill opening, the legs. She hadn't even carved legs. Where had they come from? Flailing. It hung, poised for a moment as if in flight, and then the marionette wrung its neck. The decoy collapsed. It was still wood. It could only be wood, but it was wood carved like a dead bird, the wings trailing down. The marionette opened its mouth, impossibly wide, showing a black, toothless opening that ran halfway down the thing's throat and bit into the mallard's breast. Wood splintered. The marionette chewed. Sawdust fell down around it, and a single wooden feather drifted to the floor. The other problem with the unleashing in C20 is it's phenomenally, terribly expensive. Unleashing costs 2 glamour, and you take a nightmare. And normally, for everyone except the Inanimate, every time you unleash, you call on the weird. If you unleash successfully, you call on the weird for a number of minutes equal to your successes. If you lose control of your unleashing, you call on the weird for the rest of the scene. For the Inanimate, it explicitly says that unless you actively, explicitly call on the weird, everything you unleash with the slivers is chimerical. Everything. So you're spending 2 glamour, you're taking a nightmare point, and you don't get to impact the real world. If you want to impact the real world, you first have to spend a glamour and spend a willpower to call on the weird, then spend the 2 glamour for the unleashing, and take the nightmare point. Yay, you get to impact the real world now. Being an anime in C20 is just back-breakingly expensive.
And jumping back just a little bit, even in the original version, in the secret way, I think a big part of the issue was that they had multiple writers and there wasn't a strong unifying, like, editing focus to give anybody guidance when they were writing. Because, like, the Willow Whisper duplicate power, okay, you want them to be able to talk to the natural world, that makes sense. They literally do that by default. The Inanimate have their own language, which is imperceptible to meat because it is the sounds of the natural world. They should, by default, be able to talk to trees, rivers, whatever. So having that power is just, again, duplicative, but it's duplicative in a way that exists probably because writer A and writer B never had a meeting together.
I suspect that that is probably very true. There are some other things that kind of crept into the secret way that fell into that category. There's a lot of stuff in the secret way that I love, and it occasionally will contradict other things that I love on their own, but the two things just don't go together. There's this whole thing about the Inanimate being fascinated with humanity, but at the same time, they age and die very quickly. They kind of age and die very quickly. Their husks basically wear out, and then they have to build new ones. But a new husk is looks very young, and a worn out husk looks very old. But then, like one page over, it will say, oh, well, the seeming of your husk doesn't actually impact how it looks. It's just how close it is to dying. And it's, and so, well, is the aging dynamic they're describing here really happening? And is that going to make it more obvious to a human who knows me that I'm a natural, thereby causing banality, which is not a dynamic they ever call out. But if the aging progression and the seeming descriptions is what's happening, it would be a problem. But then 2 pages over, it said you can ignore the relationship between how close your husk is to being worn out and an age description. There's a lot of that in the book. And if there had been a clearer vision from the beginning, it's not like any one description is problematic. They're all kind of interesting and invoke certain types of stories. It's that they're all there together.
Right. We've had a lot of conversations recently about the things we loved, and like just between the two of us, like we came away from reading most, if not all, of this book with some very different ideas about how an anime worked as player characters and as NPCs, and how their husks worked, and how slivers could work if they were written better. And it was a weird experience for me talking about this stuff with you, because I was kind of like, I didn't read this book that long ago, did I?
Well, and what started a lot of those conversations were, we read C20, and there were several rules in C20 that you were not a big fan of and related to the ananime. And then I went back and I'd read the flavor section of the ananime book a while ago. But in preparation for this episode and for a chronicle I'm getting ready to run, I dove into the crunch section. And a lot of the rules that I think you had forgotten because you've been using the Dark Ages rules for so long now, they weren't new to C20. And a lot of the things like the, I forget what it is, but you age like a year every week that you're in a husk, and then you age extra years when you take banality. I mean, husks wear out crazy fast.
It's 3 years for a temporary point of banality.
Yeah, yes, 3 years for a temporary point of banality, or a year per week the husk exists, I think it is. I think it's both of them. And I remember you read that in C20, and it's like, oh my God, if you actually have a human that you're interested in and engage with, and you don't see them for a few weeks, and a couple banality triggers happen, you come back, you look a decade older. They see you, oh, have another banality trigger and age 3 years in front of their eyes. I mean, it's a never-ending cycle of disbelief. And, and I thought that does seem a little weird. To me, I didn't see the ananime interacting with humans as much as Simon did. But I did think that that rule seemed a little intense, and I wasn't quite sure why they added it in C20. And then I was reading through the rules in Secret Way. That's exactly what's in Secret Way. But you had completely forgotten that, again, I think because you've been using the Dark Ages rules. It's a
Right, and in
strange
Dark Ages,
approach.
like, they don't age at all because they're free-floating true fae. And in our game, I rewrote a bunch of that because they shouldn't be that after the shattering. But the thing I rewrote most of the facade rules off of was the description of the husk background in Secret Way, which is at odds with a bunch of the rest of the book.
Yeah, it really is. Well, and there are other rules that are kind of odd, like in the life cycle description of the ananime, they talk about how they go into this state called somnolence, and somnolence is basically death for an ananime. Death, sort of the way you have death for a changeling soul, that period between incarnations. It's a deep sleep where they dive into their anchor and they're inactive for years and years and years at a time. And by and large, the vast, vast, vast majority of the ananime went into somnolence when the shattering happened. They were just shocked into this long, inactive state. And it wasn't until the resurgence, big air quotes around that, because was it the she coming back? Was it something specific to the ananime? It depends on what part of the book you read. In one area, it's like they have their own mini resurgence. In another area, it's just, well, they started coming back a couple years early, but it was because the glamour was building. It really just depends on the framing. But they came back because of all the glamour coming back into the world, whether it was unique to them or the moon landing, however you want to take that. And then the Solomon's rules are for after that long Solomon's. If you sort of die, you get so much banality, you go back into your anchor and you can purge it, which makes sense if you think about meat changelings reincarnating, you age, you become a grump, you become undone, you die, you're reborn into a child, your banality is lower. Yay. Except the way the rules are written are you go back into your anchor, and okay, your banality is higher than your glamour. It will go down, I think it's like one every so many years, until it's your banality is two lower than your glamour, and then you wake back up. Which does two things. One, the higher your glamour, the less banality you can get rid of, which makes no sense. And two, you just wake up when it hits this benchmark, even though what's described in all the narrative is similar to a normal changeling chrysalis. There has to be some burst of glamour, some the resurgence, someone being inspired next to your anchor, particularly strong fey magic happening near your anchor. There's some trigger that causes you to pop back up and become active again. And the other thing that struck me, and I wrote up some alternate rules for this that made more sense in my head anyway. But when I was done, I looked at them and I went, this is the equivalent of a changeling dying. This is their reincarnation path. Why are there rules for this? Like, it should be you come back when it makes sense for the story. Because literally, it's described in terms of years and decades. That's not something that's going to happen in a normal chronicle context. Now, there are chronicles that will go multi-generation. Oh, we want to play through multiple lifetimes of the same fey soul, and that's valid. And I would have loved a write-up for, hey, if you want to have the same inanimate soul through multiple solemnances, and here's how remembrance is a little different for them, but it's still a problem. They still lose memory when they go through this process, just less than meat changelings. Here's how you would approach that and make narrative recommendations instead of introducing a dice system that you're probably never going to use with a single character. It was unusual both that it was written into the original book and that they preserved it in C20.
In our game, which has a lot of golden ruling going on around the anime that I didn't realize was golden ruling until we started talking about this. But in our game, I ended up rewriting Remembrance specifically for the anime because I had completely forgotten about some numlunts and all of that, and had been running off. Well, okay, sure. Why do they have a completely unbroken memory going back to the mythic age? That's weird. I need to figure out what makes them die so that they can reincarnate. And in our game, we ended up using any traumatic disjunction from the facade as their death. So whenever you experience critical damage to the facade and it breaks, so through violence, and then you're, for an anime, their mien is called a dream form, and your dream form is slammed back into your anchor, that triggers remembrance for your next husk. So your next husk gets built, and then you pop out of your anchor again, and you have to roll remembrance to remember things about what your last husk was doing. Which is a little bit more brutal than the way some numlunts works. That's completely fair. But you also get back in the action faster. So I think that's kind of a fair trade-off.
Yeah, and I mean, you're also doing that sort of multi-generation long winter interregnum story, and the inanimate are such mayflies in the rules that I don't know that the core rules for the inanimate would work really well for the scale of the story you're telling.
No, and like to get around their whole aging banality thing. I mean, the husk is completely artificial. The anime makes it, and the husk background reflects how good they are at it. In Dark Ages Fae, an anime could disguise themselves as a human being And for them, it was an activity based around their weaving ability. You built your disguise. It was a function of using your human-like mind to create something that other human-like minds would perceive and think of as human. And that makes sense to me, especially since the inanimate are kind of coming at it from the other angle than the firstborn, where the firstborn are, we are alien, and that's all we are, and that's all we're ever going to be. Ha ha. They have to use magic to hide themselves. The inanimate use their understanding of humans to hide themselves. And even in modern inanimate settings, when they enter their anchor voluntarily, like if they're going into their kingdom, they break down their husk and they enter their dream form in order to go into the anchor. You can't take your husk into the anchor with you. And even the husk for them is a little bit too much like meat, which they find kind of gross. It's a condescension they make to interact with the real world.
They look at meat changelings as being very strange and probably perverse for wrapping themselves up in flesh. If you're going with the Cathayian version of history, why would you take this glorious form you've been gifted by the Tuatha and change it?
In Dark Ages Fae, when the inanimate enter their anchor, which very few of them have in that period, but when they enter fairyland, they have to break down their husk again. So they use their mist score to reflect that, where they use their weaving score to reflect their disguise, the firstborn are the other way around. They use their mist score to reflect their disguise, and their weaving score to bring themselves back into tune with fairyland. So the whole thing is really messy, although I think a little bit less messy than the way it worked out in Secret Way.
Yeah, Secret Way is full of just really great ideas. I love the opening fiction. I love the psychology, and I actually really love inanime politics. Like, I could dig an inanime political game. Like, I read their political situation and the puppet salamander that the Glooms had propped up and put in charge of their kingdom, and the dynamics there, and the outcast other, salamanders, and I'm like, man, the Ventrukin eat their heart out. This is brutal.
It's beautiful and it's so slow boil.
Yeah, it really is. The other thing that, is worth talking about a little bit, because it kind of gets into some of what we were talking about earlier with the global weirdness, is the relationship the inanimate have to meet changelings. The Secret Way talks a fair bit about the relationship that the inanimate have with the Cathayian, and it's described that they have, envoys from their kingdoms to the Cathayian and their relationships, and we're all from the dreaming together, at least in the Secret Way. And I think maybe in C20 you take your legacies from the standard Cathayian legacies, and there's a whole relationship there. Except again, elements are everywhere. And the inanimate in North America should have a relationship with the Nunahi. The whole weird relationship with the Hisien and the changelings are like, oh, we don't know what this dreaming thing is. We're not really Fae. Except the inanimate are completely wrapped up in the dreaming. And are there no elements in Asia now? I mean, it's weird. But the other thing that it does is it sort of brings up the question of, well, okay, so beyond just the oddness of these places, what do you do in a game with Nunahi and Cathayian? What is the relationship between the inanimate and the Nunahi when the Cathayian are still there? So what's the relationship between the Glooms and the rock giants, or the Undine and the water babies, or the other sort of water Nunahi? There's kind of a corollary there. There's some sort of implication, although I don't think it's intentional, that there's a relationship. The other strong connection is that, by and large, the inanimate gather glamour the same way the Nunahi gather their version of glamour medicine. They gather it from the earth. Now, with the Nunahi, it's broader. They gather it from untouched land. With the inanimate, they gather it from their element. So, a Salamand couldn't gather from a river, and, an Undine couldn't gather from a breezy day, but they gather it from their own element. I don't know, Simon, you've done more actual play with the inanimate. How have you found that's played out in your games?
Oddly, especially as written, the inanimate can draw glamour from their anchor at very low difficulties, which is, it opens some really interesting and honestly kind of brokenly exploitable mechanics for the crafted, because, most gladelings, their anchors are large or sort of abstract and intangible and can't be carried. You can't move a river around. You can move around the river, but you can't move the river really. You can't move a mountain around. You end up with them doing more like the Nunahi gathering method, where you're taking from a representation of your element, if not your anchor itself. And I might be remembering this wrong, but I think they can actually draw from things that aren't their element. It's just slightly impossible. It's not rules impossible.
Yeah, so in C20, and I think they refined this a little bit, there's harvesting, and harvesting, I think, is basically the equivalent of musing, in that you can sort of take a little bit of glamour off the top. The difficulty, if you're taking from your anchor, is your banality. If it's almost the exact same substance as your anchor, but it's not actually your anchor, it's your banality plus one. Vaguely similar substance, same empire, banality plus three, and an inanimate object from a different empire is banality plus four. You have to revert to your true self and connect with the fabric of the empire's element in some way. The contact has to be uninterrupted for an hour before the roll is made. It's an unusual system because it's basically like, I've got some time to kill in my anchor, I guess I can get some glamour. It just makes glamour feel less precious than it is for other changelings. It seems strange, especially comparing it to the Nunahi. And in the original book, The Secret Way, they directly relate the glamour harvesting method to the way the Nunahi gather glamour. But with the Nunahi, it's super rare. But with the inanimate, they seem to have a lot of access to it, which, I don't know, it seems unusual to me. It just seems kind of strange.
As written, anyway, the inanimate can also muse humans in the presence of their anchor. Anybody with a good survival instinct would not do. Even a dreamer introducing them to your anchor invites banality in a way you can't fight.
The way it was described in The Secret Way, it almost sounded more like an accidental thing. Like, if a dreamer became inspired in the presence of your anchor, yay, you can get some side glamour. But it wasn't really described in terms of the kind of active inspiration that meat changelings do. And so that felt weird to me. It's not something you could go out and choose to do. I mean, I suppose you could, like, as your husk, go out and, like, bring a dreamer back to your anchor. But again, that it isn't the way it was described, and that gets into no inanimate would do that. It's way too risky.
It gets back to what kind of a game are you trying to run issues, because if you're running a dreaming game rather than a Cathayne game or a Nunahi game or the like three people out there who probably run Xian games. If you want these things to come across as valid player choices, all of the harvesting systems need to be reworked at least a little bit, because the Nunahi get screwed. And the anime have an easier time of it than the Nunahi do, but it's, unless you're playing right next to their anchor or they have a portable anchor, they're having a rough time of it too compared to the Cathayne. And in our game, we ended up having to rework the whole thing because it was just the systemic preference for Cathayn made it really hard to play anything else.
Yeah, and that gets into something that was actually exacerbated in C20 with the Inanimate, and that is the why would you choose to play these Fae? I mean, with the rapid dying cycles and everything else that's going on in the Secret Way, the Inanimate feel kind of alien and different. But I could sort of imagine playing one. I really loved playing the Parosim in your Chronicle, but that was sort of using the modified Dark Ages Fae rules. But in C20, the unleashing rules are so brutal, and similar to the Solemnance rules, I wrote up some tweaks to the unleashing rules. I didn't sort of gut it completely and try to go back to structured slivers. I just went, okay, what's the intent here? Can I kind of suss that out? And it's fixable. I don't love the unleashing only dynamic, but you can make it work. But as written, you have very little control. If you use magic as often as a changeling does, you're going to be in bedlam very quickly because you're picking up so much nightmare, which is also weird because the Inanimate were described as being resistant to bedlam in the Secret Way, and now they're super
Right.
susceptible to it.
Right, and in C20, their whole we're resistant to bedlam thing is reduced to, well, they don't get madness from being in the dreaming, which, okay, but again, what kind of a game are you trying to run? Because they don't have a way to navigate the dreaming outside of their kingdoms. They can unleash with their slivers to create portals into the near dreaming, but then they run into the trouble of, well, where did you end up and is there a silver path there? And I don't strongly believe that an anime would take a bunch of meat changelings into their kingdom or even their anchor, really. It seems likely to invite the accusation from other anime that you're a traitor.
Yeah, it really does, given the politics of the Inanimate and the division between the Crofted and the Gladelings, which is also kind of a weird dynamic because that, oh, you have been sullied, you've been touched by human hands, and so you're wrong. That division between the untouched, pristine, perfect, and the shaped by humans is a very sort of Western cultural concept. When you get into cultures that have, I'll say, a less antagonistic relationship with the natural world than a lot of cultures with European origins have, then that division makes less sense.
And that segues into a part of the anime game that's not super well defined. What is an anchor? Mechanically, this becomes important when an anime become untethered, or if their anchor becomes crafted, or there are a couple of really important situations in the game that need to know what a potential anchor looks like. And the only place that was really particularly well defined as a potential anchor was Balefires. And even then, those only for the salamanders. Especially in the interregnum period we're playing, freeholds are extremely rare, and an anchor is functionally a freehold for at least one changeling for the Inanimate. But you run into weird problems that weren't considered when the Inanimate were written. Because even meat changelings, if they eat things from the dreaming, they should be able to recover glamour that way. So, what's in an anchor? Like, what's in a kingdom? Is a kingdom just like a strange fairy tale representation of the element? Is it potentially like livable for a meat changeling? Would they find food there? It's all kind of vague. One of the things we ended up golden ruling in to make the game more playable for everyone, but in anime in particular, is the idea of a wellspring. Places that are close to the dreaming, even though the shattering happened. These places have a functional banality of more than zero, but less than one, and they produce dross every season relevant to the thing that makes them special. So, for example, a forest that's a wellspring might produce berries, herbs, nuts, moss, leaves, bark. These things could be dross in different seasons. A spring that is a wellspring might produce water that caught the reflection of a lunar eclipse or some kind of celestial syzygy. These could be their dross. Or a wellspring that's a sea or a beach might produce beach glass or tumbled stones or ore, jewelry, basically, that are dross. And all these places are easier for Ninihi and Inanimate to draw glamour out of. And these places are potential anchors for the Inanimate in our game. Because that's something that was never really addressed in the canon. What does an unoccupied anchor look like? And defining what an anchor that isn't occupied looks like and acts like is important if you have a player who's playing an anime and gets untethered.
Yeah, and it's interesting in a world where glamour is so precious and so limited, the inanime and the fact that they all have their own kind of personal little wellspring of glamour would be very coveted. And it creates some potentially very antagonistic dynamics. Beyond just the, oh, disdainful, we don't like meat, you end up with some really juicy potential for fights over resources, and especially the Shadow Court, or particularly sort of ugly, unseelie groups going in and really victimizing the inanime. There's a lot of pretty brutal story there that I could see becoming sort of an inverse wellspring, a wellspring of banality, because there's also a lot of potential there for banality triggers and, oh, I'm victimizing you to take your glamour, but oh, I'm damaging part of the dreaming doing it.
The human story there gets really tricky too in our game. We're coming up on a point where the city is growing out to the anchor of one of the inanimate NPCs we've been using. And what do you do? These are people's houses. These are, the places human beings exist. They're also killing the inanimate.
I mean, and that's really the thrust of their story in the modern setting. I mean, that's a lot of what is discussed and framed in their book are those sorts of conundrums, especially now that in C20, Knockers and some of these other more modern dreams, they could be part of that dream of conquest, the dream of, as ridiculous as this is, suburban living and expanding the city and development and growth. And those aren't framed as being as banal as they used to be, potentially not banal at all, but you're literally wiping out huge swaths of creatures of the dreaming. And so that needs to have repercussions, whether they're just political repercussions in the inanime fighting back, or repercussions directly from the dreaming.
I'm really looking forward to putting the problem to the players and seeing what they decide to do. I think I know where they're going to go with it because they tend to go full Captain Planet pretty quick, but it'll be interesting because it's a historic development, one that actually took place. So it could provoke a pretty bad backlash if they aren't subtle about how they fight back against it.
I mean, something that I'm hoping to do in my upcoming chronicle is I have my game set in Asheville, North Carolina, and Asheville is very close to the eastern band of the Cherokee, and I want there to be a major Nunahi influence, but also a very major Cathayan influence, because Asheville would have a huge Cathayan influence. And I want to have both of those groups strongly allied with the group of Inanimate for different reasons. I found various organizations in Asheville where that would make sense for the Cathayan. But I want to kind of get into that play of the stress of the politics, not just that are presented in the canon already, but of inanime that have chosen to have some sort of relationship with meat, but different meat. And maybe they don't have the same legacies. And what does that mean? I think that that'll almost all be crafted. I don't want to get into that with gladelings. But for the inanimate that are touched by humans in, the secret way, they're presented as all kind of being on the same page. Well, nobody having anything to do with humans is going to be on the same page with anything else that has anything to do with humans. And I want to kind of see how that'll play out.
Yeah, my personal headcanon for how the anime have been working in our stories have been that they're closer to what the Fae were for Dark Ages Fae. Like, the Anchor really is the home of the spirit that is the anime, but that each different anchor produces different personalities that take form in the real world through facades, and these personalities don't have to all be on the same page with each other because, anybody who has had ambivalence towards anything knows what it feels like to be able to see the benefits or the negatives of the same actions. Another thing that I'm hoping we get to at some point in the near future, before this particular inanimate NPC probably ends up dying, is this NPC is a colony organism. It's a birch colony, which is a thing that exists and is super fascinating. But like that's the sort of organism that could survive having part of itself harvested. I'm really interested in doing a little bit of a subplot involving a successful crafting of only part of it that produces another inanimate that is crafted while the previous gladeling still exists and there's a potential for them to meet each other.
That is super interesting, and it also gets into something I've thought a lot about to go even farther back than Dark Ages Fae. The inanimate are kind of true Fae, but they kind of remind me of the Unshaped. If you think about the kingdoms and the fact that every anchor leads back to the kingdom, everything is an extension of the element. All inanimate are an extension of their element. They kind of operate like Unshaped, where they're each an emanation of the kingdom. It makes the implications of the Solomon's kingdom really messy, to say the least, but the model mostly works. Part of what I think it evokes for me is in Graceful Wicked Masks, they talk about the situation where a single Unshaped can have multiple emanations and they don't have to agree with each other. Where two or three emanations can love and be obsessed with humans and creation, and two or three emanations can basically be members of the Balorian Crusade. And they're still part of the same entity, they just represent that entity's divided nature and his indecision, its indecision about this issue. And so it's various thoughts that are in conflict manifest as personalities. And thinking about the inanimate that way is really interesting. And when they talk about the other kingdoms that may have been lost, but maybe there are a few representatives left of, it really continues to reflect that. And it makes the division between the crafted and the uncrafted more of a bit of violence because we are all still one, but we're not. And so I like that you're finding a way to take what is a big, messy cosmological, I suppose, I guess I could look at the kingdoms that way concept. And make it more obvious and accessible to the to players through the no, this is a birch colony. This is an organism. Because that's so much easier to grasp in the context of a story. And so I really like how you're tapping that.
The other thing related to this approach that I'm using is also getting back to the inanimate having their own language that is mostly incomprehensible to meat. Inanimate have names for themselves in their own language. That makes sense. Like, that's the way everything else operates. But how do you translate, sound that water falling down this sort of rock makes into English or whatever language? And the thing I, in my own head, it hasn't actually come out in the game yet because nobody's really been interested in looking into it, is that the anime that I use as NPCs are complicated and, like, they're different facades, although serial in every case so far have had different names for themselves, but nobody's asked. and these names are all kind of short poems describing the thing they think they are. So, for example, using large geographic phenomenon as a source for an anime, you can end up with even an anime of different kingdoms coming from the same anchor, because you could have a mountain, that's the anchor. You could have a facade that's generated by the refractions of dawn in the dew on the leaves on the mountain. You could have a facade that's generated by the flint at the heart of the mountain. You could have a facade that's generated by the river running down from the top of the mountain. All of those would be different people, and they would have different personalities, at least in my mind.
No, that totally makes sense. It also gets into the messiness of what is identity. In the unshaped model of the mountain is the unshaped, and all these various things are its emanations. But the river is also an emanation of river. It's an emanation of Ondine. It's both of those things, which is, on one hand, maybe a little more mage territory. It's a little more heady, esoteric weirdness than a lot of changeling players tend to want to get. I still find it really fascinating. You know, part of what I like about the Fae is their ineffableness, and I like those moments where just for a moment that ineffableness kind of almost comes into focus, and you're like, oh no, but that makes my head hurt. And I feel like this is a great territory for that, where, you know, kind of like the really old fairy tales, the fairy tales that aren't like Brothers Grimm, but are like from the era where people worshipped the Fae as animist deities. It's like on one hand, we don't understand them and they're ineffable and they're dangerous, but we worship them and sometimes they're nice to us. But really, all of that is because we don't understand the world and we're terrified of it. And they're not alien any more than a lightning strike is alien, any more than death is alien. They're not alien at all. They're intimate. We live with them always, but we're afraid of them. They're not malevolent. We're just afraid of them because they are these things we're afraid of. And I love that space.
Yeah, they're not malevolent, they're indifferent at best.
Yeah, exactly. Which indifferent
Right.
is still dangerous.
Extremely. Indifferent humans are dangerous to me.
Valid, very, very valid.
He breathed. I am Susurra. He flashed his eyes in the tree lady's direction and then smiled with jaunty pleasure as she blushed again. In his mortal-esque form, he wore a flowing white poet shirt over loose-fitting jeans, dappled as if stained by bleaching. His flaxen hair whipped against his pale cheeks and waved around sky-blue eyes. Karen stood and dipped a noble curtsy to the breeze. How do you do? She replied as taut and shared her most becoming smile. My name is Karinay. I'm a she, a lady of House Fiona, but I'm a childing, so I can't tell you what to do yet. The innocent honesty in her tone indicated clearly that she meant no insult, so none was taken. Karen looked at her friend and gently pushed back a shock of leaves that had fallen forward to hide the renewed blush. This is my friend, Tree Lady, Karen introduced. She doesn't talk. Sasura's eyebrows floated upward, and his head tilted to view the Tree Lady from a different angle. She doesn't talk, but I heard you both singing. That was why I decided to breeze by. With a sad shake of her head, Karen replied, No, she rustles and taps and makes pretty sounds, but she doesn't talk. Her childlike acceptance of the fact seemed complete. I talk, the tree lady murmured, but she never listens.
Those are most of our feelings on the anime. We've had, Simon and I have had several twisting conversations, and we may end up pulling in a couple other ideas we have into later episodes. But just the core of what are these strange alien elemental creatures, and what are some of the rules, dynamics, and plot points, and ways that you can use them? Those are really most of what we end up talking about when we talk about the anime, and I really hope that it's been useful and that you are able to glean some potential for your games out of this. Thank you very much for listening. And for both Simon and myself, I hope you come back and listen to the next episode of Walking Away from Arcadia.
The readings from this conversation were from In Anime, The Secret Way and Dark Ages Fae. The music from this episode was LSD by Mon Plaisir. Today's poorly explained echo. If a tree falls in the woods and no one is there to hear it, is it still a banality trigger?